Osimumfarms.com.
So even when we started Osimum, for instance, in 2001, I had moved back from Chicago. We moved back here. And at that point, I think nobody knew what bioinformatics was. We were one of the earliest companies in the space. And for us to go from there, where we knew nothing about bioinformatics, I was my undergrad and my master's and all, nothing was in the biotech or bioinformatics space. So our 2 out of 3 founders came from physics and finance, and one came from genomics. I think from there, to have built one of the largest genomics services companies worldwide, I think I have a huge amount of confidence that, you know, we'll be able to, with that experience behind us, that, you know, if there's somebody who can make a difference, we'll be able to do that.
Hi, welcome to Pathbreakers. I'm your host, Upendra Namburi, and this is being hosted on Awaaz.com. Our guest for today, Anu Acharya, is the CEO of MapMyGenome, an Indian organization leveraging genomics to enhance the quality of life. She is an alumnus of IIT Kharagpur and the University of Illinois. Anu is perhaps one of the few professionals in India who has dedicated her life to the area of genomics. She has served as the CEO of GeneLogic and Okimum Biosolutions. She started her current venture, MapMyGenome, way back in 2013 and has been tirelessly crusading the use and application of genomics to consumers, corporates, and institutions alike. In this discussion with Anu today, we are planning to understand genetics and genomics a bit better, its impact on our lives, what it takes to run a business in genomics, and the road ahead. Of course, her journey in this magical world of genes and genetics. On that note, Anu, a warm welcome to Pathbreakers.
Thank you so much, Upendra. It's great to be on the show.
So we're really looking forward to this chat, Anu. So to kick this off, and I'm used to asking you dumb questions, so you know what I'm going to ask you. What's a gene? What's genetics? And what's genomics?
Sure. So if you take any part of your saliva, blood, or anything, you know that we have a lot of cells, and within them is DNA. And in that DNA, we find that we have 22,000 or so genes. And the collection of the entire genetic material, that whole genes and everything else, is called a genome. When you're talking about a gene, then you're looking at one of those genes that you got. Half of them, they came from your mom, and half of them came from your dad. And so you're looking at one specific gene within that, which is embedded within those 23 pairs of chromosomes in our cells. So when you're saying a gene, like a BRCA gene, then you're looking at only one specific part of your entire genome. So your entire genome would be a fairly large number of letters, like A, C, T, G. So there are about 3.2 billion base pairs of them. So when you take that entire material, that is called as a genome. So when you're studying a genome, you're looking at the entire material that is there. That is the 3.2 billion base pairs. When you're saying, I'm looking at studying genetics, you could be looking at one individual gene as well. So when you're saying, for instance, that somebody has cystic fibrosis or something else, then you're looking at specific changes in your genes that are causing those diseases. So that's the basic difference. So it's a single gene versus multiple, or the entire set of genes that are there, which is called the genome.
Okay, thanks for that, Anu. And how is gene sequencing different? What is gene sequencing?
So if you break it down, just like you have, for instance, when you're reading a book, and it's made of 26 letters, right? So you have A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, and so on. Now, when you are reading what is there in your genes or in your genome, you're basically reading the letters of your genome, which are just in 4 letters, A, C, T, and G. Basically, that's when you're sequencing them, you're basically trying to understand what is that chemical base that you're reading. So whether it is an A, whether it's a C, T, or G, you're reading that sequence in that genetic material. So if you had to sort of think about it as a book, then you have a book which has 23 pairs of stories in there. And within each story is your gene, but they're all written in A, C, T's, and G's.
Wonderful. All right. Much clearer. Thanks for that, Anu. And tell me, Anu, I'm sure you're asked this question quite often. Mm-hmm. Is it really so complicated to understand the concepts of genetics and genomics?
So it depends on how far you want to get into. It depends on your level of what you understand from a basic sense. But if you just want to understand it from a consumer point of view, it is not that complicated, because ultimately it is about looking at those letters of, you know, what is it, what changes have made me unique, or what changes have made me different from somebody else. So for instance, between any two individuals, the genetic material is going to be 99.9% alike, right? So regardless of any human being across the planet, that's going to be the same. Now, the differences when you're trying to understand, you know, we all look different or unique. You know, we are different in terms of how we behave to certain circumstances, and also how you respond to certain health diseases, and how you respond to food more also importantly. So I think even those, just the 0.1% difference is what is making those changes for an average individual to understand, you know, why for some people it's okay to eat a lot of fatty foods versus for others it is, you cannot eat any amount of protein, or someone rather has curly hair, someone has straight hair, all of that. So a lot of these changes, whether it is physical changes, whether it is changes internally, are all caused by small changes in your DNA sequence. And that change is the one that sort of determines why you and I are different from each other, and why our genomic signature is different from each other. But it's very, very alike as well.
So Anu, this is like a key which unlocks an individual to their secrets.
Correct.
Of different aspects of their life and the physiology, as you've said.
Yes.
Then I must ask this question. If it is as potent and as powerful as it is, why is the knowledge and adoption of this possibly not as large as we imagine it should be?
One is that it is a fairly new science, right? It's basically like understanding the software of how your body works, and how you look, and how you react to certain things. But to be honest, I mean, this has just been a science that the first human genome project was only completed in 2001 to 2003 timeframe. So it's not been that long ago, right, that, you know, we knew all this information. Now, knowing that about one person, and at that point, billions of dollars were spent in trying to get to that point, right? I think today, almost 20 years later, we find that the technology has evolved to an extent where the cost has come down fairly dramatically. But it's still not yet within the reach of everybody to get the entire genome sequenced. But at the same time, I think we are seeing that, you know, understanding this from the three aspects, whether it is, you know, the price aspect, whether it is awareness aspect, and trying to get large numbers of people to understand its implications in disease, in implications in health, and implication in many other places, is a fairly time-consuming and takes a while to be able to get to certain conclusions. Then it also depends on not just genomics. There are also other factors, whether it is in terms of, you know, your epigenetics and other things that cause disease. So it is not just on and off. It's not basically saying that, you know, if you have this mutation, you will have it, because in many complex conditions, you have to look at many other pieces of the puzzle as well, right? So I think our understanding has improved a lot in the last 20 years. And I think given the fact that it has improved, I think it has already gone through that hype cycle in the beginning, where, you know, everybody assumed that all drugs will be created just by a click of a button, to now saying that this is something that you will look at when you look at the number of drugs that the FDA is approving based on biomarkers, on genomics and others. I think the numbers have been rapidly increasing. So it's not that nothing has been done, but it's just that, like every new technology, like every new understanding of every area, it takes a while to get to that point. And I think today we are getting to that point that, you know, it's becoming very accessible, it's becoming cost effective, and it's also coming to a point where people have started to understand the value. And I think over the next 3 to 4 years, we'll start to see that, along with a lot of the large country projects, along with a lot of private company efforts, I think it will become part of a lot more standardized testing for everybody. So I think we are at that cycle where, you know, it is just starting to see value for the average consumer. So it is not something that wasn't being done for the last few years, but it has gone beyond now where it was in the research areas first to now in the clinical side. So I think there is time that it has taken, but in terms of the larger scheme of things, it has been fairly rapid in terms of the way the technology has evolved, the way people have started to understand this space. But there still needs many other pieces to make sure that this can reach everybody. You know, everybody can know about it, somebody can pay for it, and there also a possibility of being able to see what value it is bringing with respect to many other things that are already in place today.
So, Anu, you mentioned pharma and the FDA. So if I were to ask you, which are the main applications or end uses where you think genetics and genomics can help?
So there are many applications. I think the most obvious ones are the ones where what we would call as personalized medicine, right? So you want to say that not every medicine works for everybody. So you want to understand why certain kinds of drugs will work for a certain person based on their genetics or other pieces of whatever we can understand about them. So that's the most common part of, from a pharma perspective. How do you create drugs for specific kinds of populations? How do you create drugs for specific individuals and so on? So we are starting to see a lot of value in where people are going through chemotherapy or other drugs that they're using to be able to help them in the treatment perspective. The second aspect is where you are looking at diagnosing something. You're looking at understanding of disease, because many times we find that many different kinds of conditions all have very similar symptoms. So you want to make sure that you can understand what is actually causing that particular condition. So, and how do you prevent it in, let's say, future generations or otherwise. So coming to that, you also can do a lot of what we call as the carrier screening. Right. So, for instance, if two people are planning to have babies, you can actually screen both the parents to understand if they both have the same mutation and if that is likely to result in an offspring who might also have, you know, those conditions and whether they are prepared for it or not. The other condition which we greatly focus on is on prevention, where you sort of understand your health risk profile. You combine it with family history, you combine it with your health history, and then you understand whether what you can do to reduce that risk for someone that is there. Then there are other applications, like you're an athlete. For you, even up, you know, 0.1 seconds in your performance might make a difference. You want to understand if you are at risk for injury or otherwise, what kind of foods are likely to be good for you and so on. So that will be another place that it is vastly popular. And then there are obvious cases of people wanting to lose weight, people wanting to be able to understand other parts of what kind of foods are going to be good for them and so on. But the most popular application across the globe, at least for an average consumer who's healthy, has been of understanding their own heritage, understanding their origins and where they came from. And I think that's more a curiosity element for an average consumer or an average human being trying to understand who am I and where did I come from. So I think that understanding of our DNA gives us answers to some very interesting questions that have haunted mankind from the beginning. And I think if we continue to do that. So these are some examples of what you can do with understanding your DNA. But you can also do things that could basically be able to, let's say, for instance, one more very recent example is that of the coronavirus. Earlier, I think whenever a pandemic broke out, you had to wait for a long time to be able to understand, you know, what caused it. Today, I think you can quickly sequence and find out what kind of mutations have happened within the virus itself and what can you do? Can you create a vaccine quickly enough or, and so on? So I think one is in helping in drug discovery. One is in coming up with, you know, more personalized medicine or more personalized drug targets for different populations and so on. Third is the set where you are preventing disease, then you have diagnosing disease, and then there's treating disease, and then the fun, interesting parts of, you know, why am I the way I am, and where did I come from, right? And why am I the way I am would include things like, you know, why do I have brown eyes or light eyes, hair. You can look at things like endurance and sprint and many other things that are there. So I think, you know, if I had to briefly, you know, divide it into many different aspects of what can be done.
So this traverses the entire spectrum from preventive to curative.
Correct.
The applications in pharma are extremely compelling. They're quite clear. Personalized medicine is, again, a hot topic. The MIT Technology Review actually said that that's one of the 10 big innovations which is possibly going to gain traction this year in 2020. Mm-hmm. Apart from pharma, which are the other industries or government bodies who could potentially benefit with this area?
So I would say one big part of what is also there, we clearly look at, you know, what pills we take with great amount of regulation and on how that impacts our health. But the other big part, which is nutrition and how you eat, is one part that I think understanding of the population that you're catering to, understanding who you are working with can be helpful for both nutrition companies as well as for governments. Governments that are trying to create plans for for sectors that they have to provide for, right? So I think that would be very helpful in saying that, do you come up with a way of providing adequate nutrition for an entire population that you're trying to come up with a low-cost solution or some way of being able to do that without compromising on nutrition? So that would be one. The second very obvious use case or industry that will be of, will tremendously benefit would also be somebody like insurance industry, because in many ways, the incentives are very strongly aligned, saying that how do you actually reduce the overall payouts? If you can prevent disease, I think you also reduce the payouts for insurance industry. So I think another industry that will strongly be affected would be the insurance industry. And the third, obviously, are employers, because if their employees are healthy, they are more productive. And therefore, as a result, I think you will start to see that the return on investment for being able to convince a group of people to be healthier, I think is also very strong on the employer. And so there's employer, there are people who are actually paying for it. And then there's the government. So in some cases, the government is paying. In some cases, it's the insurance industry paying. Sometimes it's the employer. And then finally, it is for the average consumer, which is actually the biggest payer in India, at least, because 62% or more is actually paid directly by the consumer. And so that becomes another very important part to be able to see. For them, it is actually a higher value if they're able to prevent disease rather than wait for it to manifest itself.
Great.
So sorry, I covered beyond your government bodies.
No, hardly. And since I come from the insurance industry, I've always been very curious what the applications for this could be. It seems fairly obvious, which then brings me to my next question. What's the main challenge you face when approaching the government or corporates and asking them to adopt or include this in their propositions and processes?
So I think one is that for the insurance industry in India, it's currently fairly small. And I think most of the times the premiums are very, very low. And I think because of that, I think it's harder for them to be able to add it to whatever they are currently doing, because mostly because of the cost perspective. Second part is that there are also aspects of where the insurance industry has been, I don't know rightly or wrongly, but a lot of times associated with potentially being able to get access to the data, which in most cases, I think most of the time they actually don't get access to the data. But that's another area that typically is a challenge to be able to make sure that they, that you understand that even if they don't get access to individualized data, there is still a great value for them. So I would say that it's not that the insurance industry is not interested. I think they are very interested because ultimately they do see the value of doing something like a genomic study, because it helps them in better understanding the risks of the population. But also I think from an overall perspective, I think we do see that. But I think currently, and as the price point is coming down, I think it becomes a lot more easier for them to be able to afford it, if I may say so. So I think that's one area. The second, so for instance, I think if you just compare it with the US or some of the other Western countries where insurance pays for a lot of expensive genetic tests, I think it's part of the model that is built in. In India, I think a lot of times, I think there are many things that are semi-regulated. And I think it becomes very hard to be able to add some of them into their current plans. So that's where I think there has to be some sort of understanding of saying that we need to, yes, understand that, there's data privacy and other concerns that are valid and necessary to look at. But second is that we also need to understand that, if the insurance companies are able to provide, good quality service to their customers, ultimately it's beneficial for everybody in the overall ecosystem. So I think it's a matter of time, but I think you will start to see a lot more happening on that front.
How has the adoption evolved in geographies outside of India? So when you look at North America, Western Europe, or even South Africa, Australia, are you seeing a higher level of adoption? Are they slightly ahead of the curve?
definitely, they are at least 5-6 years ahead, in at least in countries like the US. But a lot of it has also been who's paying for these testing. And because about 5-6 years ago, some of these tests could be as high as a few thousand dollars, you can't expect that to be paid by the current insurance industry in India because of the current premiums, right? But if you look at whether it was BRCA screening, they were detecting people with breast cancer so early that most of them, you know, more than 90% survival after that has been seen.
Great.
But that was all because insurance industry paid for testing, whether it was BRCA, whether it was looking at, you know, or the government's paying for, let's say, newborn screening and others, but somewhere in the loop that somebody else was paying for these testing. So even though the cost of these tests were very high, because the payer was not the consumer, we've started to see a lot of these applications actually being reimbursed. But at the same time, I think what we have also seen over the last 5-6 years and more is a rise in the consumer testing as well. And that has come about for two reasons. I think the most popular reason for testing has been the fact that, you know, it has become very affordable.
Great.
At least according to, you know, the Western world, I think $100 or so is a fairly reasonable cost to have for buying a test. But most of the time, these are used as gifts for, you know, different times of the year, whether it's Thanksgiving or Christmas or other times. And these are mostly for the more fun part of the testing, which is ancestry and others trying to find out, you know, how closely you resemble some other population or not. And now what we saw that in India, at least when we launched about almost 6.5-7 years ago, we actually started with focus on health because we believe that health has a longer lasting value from a consumer perspective. So if we can provide value over a long period of time, might take longer time to get them excited, but it's also something that is a longer term engagement rather than a one-time fun thing to know about your heritage. So I think for us, we started with health and we've added on heritage only recently. The rest of the world, I think it has been that a lot of the clinical tests were being reimbursed and either approved by the FDA or a CLIA approved test or tests that are approved for reimbursement. And the second part was the growth, a very rapid growth of the consumer testing, primarily on the ancestry part. And now we are starting to see more and more, most of those companies moving towards health as well.
In a market like India, in the next few years, do you see this to be more a B2B or a B2C kind of a play? How do you see this market evolving?
I would say that it would be more a B2B2C, right? So somewhere you still have to get the consumer, but it would depend on if there are people who see value in it, then there is likelihood of those consumers, you know, getting access to a whole large number of customers through a different channel that is available.
Got it. Okay, then I have to ask you this. As a leader, mm-hmm. it really must take a crazy amount of effort for you to be going and one, explaining this concept and then trying to make a commercial sale out of it. Any experiences that you'd like to share and how do you keep standing there?
I think it has been very exciting because, you know, when I first was running Osimum and JingLogic, I think typically you always work with people who are already experts in their fields, you know, either, you know, somebody who had a translational medicine, someone who's bioinformatics, someone or others. You didn't have to explain to them, you know, what is DNA, what is a gene, what is a test, you know, how is it different from a horoscope and things like that, right? So it was a very different kind of discussion that you would have with somebody who's already well-versed with the language that you're speaking. I think coming to Map My Genome, I think was incredibly exciting because, you know, here you are trying to explain to an average person what this technology can do to impact your own life. And I think if we are able to crack that, I think you're able to impact so many more people that for me it became a great, you know, very exciting challenge to take up. But the first thing that we had to do was we really had to come up with something that would resonate with what people already knew, because if you're going directly to consumers, most people were not even aware what a genetic test is, you know, except for maybe those who've had either, you know, a problem or disorder, or somebody who's either looked at, let's say, a paternity or maternity testing in somewhere. So I think in 2013, that was a situation that most people were not even aware of it, except those who had lived outside and they had heard about, you know, some ancestry test or the other. So I think from that point, for us to come up with, you know, to launch Genome Patri as, you know, something that at least got people's attention, to going around, you know, basically talking to everybody that potentially could influence people's health and others, I think it has been a very exciting journey, because people at least understand what a DNA test is. We don't have to start from scratch. I think, so in the last 6 years, I think we've made a lot of progress. I think today it is mostly about people understanding whether it is something that can be done sitting in their homes, or whether they have to come to our labs to be able to do the test. So I think the discussion has moved from saying, I don't know what you're talking about, to us now asking whether they have to come to our place and what is the price point that they can get it at. So I think that has changed a lot in terms of how the average consumer looks at it. We still obviously have a very large population that we still haven't been able to tap. And I think one of the areas that we are just started to do is to look at different languages. And we've just launched our Hindi website just today. And the plan is to be able to make information and the knowledge that we are creating on our blogs and on our videos and others more accessible to the average Indian, because very few people in India actually understand and speak English. The large majority actually speaks many other languages. So I think that's something that we are cognizant about, and we are trying to see how we can expand our scope of whatever impact that we can have on the average consumer to a larger population within Indian subcontinent.
How much does it cost for me to do a test like this?
So it depends on what kind of test you want to do. There can be something as simple as a 1,000 rupee test as well. But our most popular test, which is Genome Patri, typically is at around the 10,000 or so. Sometimes it's at 7,000 if there's a sale. But on the average, it is in that price range of less than 10,000.
So help me understand, is it an expensive business to get into? Is the nuts and bolts of this tech very expensive? What's making this entire unit so expensive?
Just a background, you know, I've been in this space for a long, you know, now almost 2 decades. So when we first sequenced a human genome, it was a few billion dollars. Then let's say if you move it down from in the 2004-05 timeframe, just doing a microarray chip used to be $12,000 to $15,000 when we started processing them. Then you move to 2011 when Steve Jobs wanted to do a full genome sequencing. The cost at that point, and that's not very long ago, was about $100,000. When we started in 2013, when we launched it at 25,000 rupees. Now, I want to explain that they're all different types of testing that can be done, and I'll explain that in a moment. But today, we are seeing that, you know, a Genome Patri would be about $100, right? So you can get it at 7,000, 8,000 rupees or in that price range. So you're seeing that it has changed a lot. And the reason why it is so expensive is the cost of the actual reagent, and which is not a reusable one. So every time you run someone's sequence, you are actually either sequencing it. So you need a lot of reagents to run it. If you're doing, let's say, a SNP-based assay, then you're doing it on a microarray. And that's a one-time use. You use it and you basically, that's what is done for a person and it's it. Now, those are expensive units. But even those have been coming down. The cost of the reagents have come down, which is why the cost of testing has also come down. There are a few companies that are now even talking about sequencing the entire genome for $100, right? Which today, actually, the average cost is about $1,200 to $1,500 or $700-$800, depending on where you get it. So I'm talking about a tenfold decrease. Maybe over the next 3 to 4 years, we'll start to see that happening as well. So it has been coming down in very, very dramatically. But for the average consumer, it is still an expensive, you know, relatively expensive. I think today it's becoming much more cheaper. We launched the Ancestry product at about 4,000 rupees, which was pretty much, you know, very affordable for an average consumer. But beyond that, I think we'll have to find ways of how do we reduce the overall, I mean, cost beyond that as well. But I'm hoping that we'll be able to get there soon enough.
Got it.
So I think one is that the cost of the reagents is expensive. Second is that we also need to have large volumes to be able to bring these costs down overall. But I think as the cost of reagents comes down, I think everybody's cost of testing will definitely come down even further. I think that over the next few years, we'll start to see that it'll become much more commonplace to be able to get a genetic test done, probably for under 5,000 rupees. And it's not too far away. We are almost there.
Great.
I think that that's where we are. Maybe at some point it'll become like the transistor where the cost became so low that the cost didn't matter at all. And maybe we'll get to that point as well. But you have to also remember that, you know, when you do a genetic test like a genome per three, you're not just doing running a test. You're not just getting a report. You're actually also getting counseling along with it. If you had to do that in the US or anywhere else, I think then the cost over there becomes very expensive because getting guidance from a person who's actually talking to you and actually understanding your family history and health history, that changes the whole paradigm completely. It becomes a lot more expensive. It'll at least get to $400-$500, even if you didn't do other parts of it. So I think that's the difference, that we are currently doing something of very high value at a cost that is, you know, much lower than the rest of the world. But the cost of our reagents is currently actually higher than for most of the rest of the world. So that's the challenge. I think we still need to make sure that, you know, at least for the government doesn't impose as high taxes on importing any of these chips that we currently have to import, right? So that's another challenge for companies in India. But having said that, I would say that it will still come to a point where the cost will become almost immaterial, and the cost of other services that we add on to it, whether it's the counseling, the recommendations that we give after the testing, and the app, the nutrition, the vitamins, and everything else that you get beyond that, I think is what would start to create more value for the consumer.
I remember a couple of years back, I got my report done, and there was a nutritionist call which happened. And then it got me thinking, if I were to go to the trainer in the gym, or if I were to go to the family doctor, there are different other stakeholders who add value in managing your health and that of your family.
Correct.
How conversant are the other stakeholders to start reading these kind of reports and using it methodically and constructively to aid the patient? Do they actually see value in this, or are they still on the fence? I'm not sure what's happening.
So I would say that there are some that understand it very well, and some that don't, and then some that are not familiar with it at all. But I think that part of the problem is that most of our academic curriculum doesn't include genetics and genomics at all, and that hasn't changed. So that is one big problem that is there. So most of the doctors who are conversant with it is because they have taken the effort in understanding it. They have actually gone out of their way to attend either seminars or, you know, done courses or otherwise. So that's one thing that is definitely needs a lot of improvement on in terms of what we can do from that point of view. But at the same time, then there's, you know, when you take nutritionists, even for them, I think it is still a newer part of understanding of the science and how do they incorporate it within the regular, you know, challenges of how do you actually create a plan using this information. So I think we did two things for the doctors as well as the nutritionists. And one of the things that we've done for doctors was that the first report can be, you know, is a very long report. It's, you know, 100 to 200 pages long, at least for the genome per three. It has a lot of details about a lot of things, even though there is a 4-5 page summary page that is there. What we are doing with our genetic counseling is that we are actually taking information from that genetic report, taking their information about their family history and their health history and what they eat and everything else, and then making it down into a very short report that can then be shown to a doctor because it's now written in the language of symptoms, of lifestyle measures and screening tests. So it's much easier to understand that than to say that, you know, this mutation has caused, you know, ABC or not. Those who are interested will definitely can go back and look at all of that detail. But those who are not, I think now we've at least simplified it to a point where it's easy for people to understand, for both the consumer as well as medical professionals to understand what is there. When we look at the pharmacogenomics report, for instance, there are guidelines that are there for medical professionals, which are called the CPIC guidelines. So we've included that for them so that they can understand that what do they really need to do if they get this report? How do they change the, you know, what are the guidance that is available for them in terms of dosage, in terms of alternate drugs and so on. And then for the nutritionists, what we're trying to do is to build some sort of a machine learning algorithm to sort of help them in being able to build something that will be of value for them. So it's not just saying that, you know, how do I actually improve whatever I'm already giving to the for the person that I'm actually treating or telling them what kind of nutrition they need, because now the inputs will be there already and they will be able to get better diet information if they've already had some plans in terms of the calories and various other pieces of that. So I think that's another innovation that our team is working on, and we will be having that out shortly as well. Because in the end, I think we can't expect to drastically change, you know, either academic curriculums. We can't expect to change a lot of that. But we have to look at how do we simplify it and make it in a language that they're already conversant with. And I think from our side, that's the effort that we are putting in there.
So when you are developing this category and market, how do you go about it? Do you say, hey, I'm going to pick up these PIN codes in Hyderabad and I'm going to pick up all the doctors, trainers and nutritionists? How do you approach this? Because I'm sure just spray carpet bombing won't work.
So in the beginning, we did some amount of that. But I think in the end, you have to find out those that are familiar with the space, right? Those that have at least some understanding or eagerness to understand how this is actually going to change their own professional, like, you know, the way they actually look at patients, the way they look at, you know, for the nutritionists, how they actually talk to their patients and so on, right? So I think in the end, it is about finding the ones that are more likely to convert, but at the same time also offering them to others as well. So for instance, whenever somebody would come to us, we would also ask them if their doctor would like to know more about it. And so we can now, you know, from our consumer base also expand that to their medical doctors. That could be one, and their nutritionist that is there. But what we've also done is that we've also have tie-ups with several hospitals across India, whether it is in the Fortis Memorial, whether it's in Apollo and so on. So I think for us, it's also about making sure that we had the right tie-ups so that we had the right audience to be able to talk to over there. And that we can now go and specifically make sure that if it is something that, you know, that is available to them, they are likely to have somebody who can also guide them through that process. It becomes easier for them to send somebody our way, because you can't expect somebody who hasn't been trained in this to do all of it. So we provide, for instance, genetic counselors that can help medical doctors to navigate through the different questions that they might have on genetics. So that's basically what we've been able to do. Some of it is to do seminars, but the other is to go individually to wherever we already have tie-ups, you know, have their presence within the facilities and then be able to provide it. Of course, it's currently a more expensive proposition than not doing it, but I think it's important to be able to create that level of awareness as well.
So you're literally sweating it out brick by brick, doctor by doctor, nutritionist by nutritionist.
Kind of.
That's a hell of a task.
It is. But I think it works. So I think once people start to understand, and within the community, it is easier for them to talk to each other than, so you need to get to a certain number of people that you can reach and the number of patients that have reached, in after which it becomes easier. Then it becomes more, you know, patients actually demanding this rather than the other way around, which is already starting to happen.
So I would imagine you are getting a fairly decent word of mouth and referrals?
Mostly it is word of mouth, actually, for us. We actually don't spend too much money on advertising. But it's mostly been word of mouth. It's mostly been, you know, doctor to doctor or, you know, talking to individual, this thing. So I would say that has, for us, We have let our product also speak to making sure that they can actually talk to other people about it and see if how we can continuously innovate so that we can give consumers a better experience. So for instance, now earlier we used to send reports by emails through a secure link. But now I think it's available on their website. Soon they'll be coming up with an app. So it's going to be a lot more, a lot of things that the consumer can look forward to. It's not just about doing a report one time and forgetting about it. But it's about, you know, giving them resources, giving them enough information. If you look through our blogs, we have blogs on pretty much every condition and its genetic, you know, the reasons and so on. So I think our aim is to see how we could become a resource for anybody who wants to get this information. I mean, most importantly, I think if it helps the consumer, if it helps the medical professional, I think it sort of helps in spreading the word about genomics in general.
And then talking about doctors, I would imagine Dr. Shashi Tharoor is also a recent fan of yours. I remember seeing his tweet and messaging you.
Correct.
All right. So was there any follow-up counseling call with Dr. Shashi Tharoor? And any tidbits you can share with us?
No, I can't share that level of detail. But
he definitely has been a customer of ours from 2013, actually.
Oh, really?
So, yes. In fact, his testimonial was on our website earlier. And Heritage, to his credit, I think was something that, you know, he did ask about for a couple of times. I kept saying we will come out with it. So the first, as soon as it came out, he was one of the earliest. And that was true of Genome3 as well. So this was his idea to tweet, and we are obviously very thrilled and excited about it.
All right. So Anu, with technology, it's a two-sided blade, right? One is you have the fabulous benefits in preventive and curative healthcare and so on. And then it raises the other debate. So what you raised a few minutes back about a couple wanting to figure out if their baby will be healthy. And then you hear of instances and labs cloning animals and potentially babies. What's your take on this two-sided sword?
So I would say, I mean, I don't know if you read, there was actually an app that was recently talked about, which was on the similar line, right? So we get a lot of people who come to us for understanding if, you know, they've had a, you know, potentially have had a disorder in the family and they want to understand the risk for future generations, right? Those couples are typically very, they fully understand, you know, the value of this knowledge. Right? That's one set of people that would probably want this kind of information. And then there are some who are planning to get married. And I think in India, I think it might not be a bad investment to make, especially for an arranged marriage. You know, it's for the good of, for both of them, especially if they've already decided to have an arranged marriage. It's nothing wrong to check and see if, you know, from a carrier screening perspective, if there's something that is likely to be there for the future generation. So it's not something that you are, not a eugenics kind of thing. It's something that people are familiar with, the fact that, you know, this is the likelihood of it being there. And therefore, you can decide at that point whether you want to go ahead or not go ahead. So that is one sort of, you know, information that is there. Many people who want to know the information and still want to go ahead and have babies because they are now counseled on the what it implies to have a child with X or Y condition. And I think that's fully a choice of the parents and whoever wants to have that child. So I think that's something that is, I think, a very fair, and it's information and knowledge that, you know, people should have. If they can get it done, I think they should do it, because it's not harming anybody. I think it's also about being prepared for anything that they might want to look at it in the future. The second part is where, you know, you are creating designer babies, right? So you can now potentially edit a gene. And there was a Chinese lab or Chinese couple that had a baby that was sort of had an edited gene in some form. When you're looking at the CRISPR babies or designer babies, then you can potentially actually change everything about them. Now, there were a lot of regulations and the overall, you know, hope that people won't do that with human babies. But, you know, you never know with technology. If it's out in one place, it's likely to get around to other parts of the world as well. So I think definitely technology is a two-sided there is definitely the good and the bad for any technology. But ultimately, I believe that the human race is smart enough to choose something that's overall going to be good for us. And that ultimately, hopefully, common sense prevails in what we are trying to do. But at the same time, when you look at it from an individual family perspective, and you look at sometimes, just how one small change in your DNA can cause a fatal condition, I think there are those people who might want to have a way of permanently removing that mutation from their family line, right? So if you have to think about it from their perspective as well. So in the end, I would say that I think there will be regulations that will sort of come up with ways on how to use this technology, because it is going to be, the technology is valuable. It's how we ultimately apply this technology that is out there. So that is one part of it. The second part, I think, is that if it were to be available today, what would happen? Would everybody have access to this technology? And I don't think so. And I think that's where the challenge will be, that I think the divide between the poor and the rich will become much, much wider, because the richer people will now also be endowed with every physical attribute and reduce the overall risk of disease and reduce a lot of things, whereas the poor people will not have access to that. So I think that's the other part of what a technology can bring to for us in the future as well. So there are clearly ethical concerns that are likely to affect if we were to go that route. But as I strongly believe, I think we will come up with something more sensible in the near future as an overall human collective.
Got it. So Anu, now I want to move to possibly understanding a little bit more about you.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like being a leader and entrepreneur in an emerging space and category like genomics and genetics in India and as a woman?
It's definitely a much more difficult space to be in than a more well-established space. But it is also a space that makes much more impact when you can make a difference in an emerging space. And I think for me, the fact that, I believe that there are not many people are already at that point where they can, do what I'm doing, that makes me feel compelled to be able to do what I'm doing in a bigger scale and a larger scale. So even when we started Osimum, for instance, in 2001, I had moved back from Chicago. We moved back here. And at that point, I think nobody knew what bioinformatics was. We were one of the earliest companies in the space. And for us to go from there, where we knew nothing about bioinformatics, I was my undergrad and my master's and all, nothing was in the biotech or bioinformatics space. So our 2 out of 3 founders came from physics and finance, and one came from genomics. I think from there to have built one of the largest genomic services companies worldwide, I think I have a huge amount of confidence that, we'll be able to, with that experience behind us, that, if there's somebody who can make a difference, we'll be able to do that. But at the same time, I think India is definitely not an easy market from creating any direct-to-consumer product. But when you do create value, I think because it's consumer-driven country, I think this is where we can see the largest amount of change. So I would say that for me, there are two reasons why I started in India and I continue to be over here. One was the fact that, I obviously, from a genetic point of view, like we have an ad which says that Mera Juta Hai Japani Patloon, Englishtani, whatever. But phir bhi mere jeans hai Hindustani, right? So in the end, I think if we need to do something, we need to have enough data on the Indian population, because that's where it's going to make the biggest difference for all of us and for me as well. So that is one part, that if we don't do that in India, where else will we be able to do something like this on the scale that we can do? And the second part is that, doing something in India definitely takes time. It's obviously much more difficult than, doing a business like this in the US because of the funding situation, because of the possibility of how the consumers can pay for it and the insurance can pay for it and so on. But I think if you're able to figure this out here, you can do it anywhere else in the world. So I think that's the part that is the most exciting. It's also, when you come to the right kind of price point, I think India is a large market as well. you know, being a woman, I think that makes no difference. I think if there was a man also would have to go through the same challenges as I would have in this space. So I would say that I don't look upon myself as being a woman, although, you know, for many other women, it would become much harder. I think definitely from a statistical point of view, you know, women typically end up raising less than 2% of the overall capital raise. So that's definitely an area that I think being a woman from a statistical point of view does have an effect. But other than that, I don't see a major difference in terms of how you run a company and otherwise.
Awesome. I'm really glad to hear that. Now, there is Anu the technologist, and then there is Anu the corporate leader, category maker, who's doing sales calls, doing trainings, trying to get contracts. Mm-hmm. Do you have those days when you possibly miss being the pure technologist?
No, I don't. Because I think, you are actually in the middle of understanding what your customer wants, in the middle of understanding, you know, how policy, you know, influences you and others. I think that's where your ideas for changes in technology also comes about. So I feel that there are many aspects to a business that if you listen carefully enough, I think is where you get the best ideas for improving and innovating your own business. And in the end, I think you are not the only person in the company who's doing that. So for me, it's important to make sure that I can, you know, guide the company through the right kind of information and strategy. But in the end, it's the team that is also developing it. I do often get a chance to actually read and contribute in many different ways on technology front as well. But I don't do any more coding and other things that are required. Although I can at least put in my meaningful input when there is a meeting on that.
Awesome. And can you describe Anu as a leader, and how do others describe you?
That's an, I think, interesting question that you should ask other people. But I would say that I get along well with people, and I'm usually not a short-tempered person. So it's easier to continue to get people to do and get excited about what they're doing. But other than that, I think I'm also quite involved. I don't think I'm a micromanager, although I do have to get involved in many cases in making sure that someone else is following up to make sure things are getting done. Because that's one thing that you need to make sure in India, without follow-up, things don't happen. But other than that, I think I do get involved with listening to a lot of what, both internally and externally, because in the end, I think that's what a leader needs to do. Because if we don't listen, we are not able to actually find the right path for ourselves.
All right, great. So, Anu, on that note, I want to bring us to the last segment. It's the rapid fire. This is a segment that you've been really looking forward to, is what you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
All right. And we do this with a little twist. Even if you give us really fabulous answers, we cannot give you a coffee hamper.
Okay. No problem.
But we might just send you a t-shirt.
Although I do have a lot of coffee and tea in my office if you ever come here.
I will. I owe you that trip. I will definitely come there. All right. So, Anu, so very quickly, mountains or beaches?
Beaches.
Awesome. Your favorite movie?
Oh, good question. I told you I won't be able to answer that. it depends on where I am at that.
No worry. The movie which comes top of your mind.
I think I recently saw a movie called Guilty on Netflix.
All right. Cool. Your first crush. And I'm sure I will not get this in your DNA report.
So I would say Richard Feynman, who was a physicist.
Oh, wow. Seriously. Amazing guy. You've read his biography?
Of course, we've read everything that he had written.
Okay.
I mean, not everything. I would probably didn't read all his actual papers. But whatever, as a child below 18, I could get my hand on.
Excellent. All right. Bungee jump or coffee?
Oh, bungee jump with coffee. I mean, I would do both.
culture or process?
Culture.
Play safe or go for broke?
Broke.
What ticks you off?
Stupidity.
And what gives you a thrill?
Adventure and being able to actually impact somebody's life.
The one thing you wish you had invented?
A brush that cleans itself. a toothbrush that would clean my mouth.
Okay. the one thing which never really fails to give you goosebumps?
Actually, our national anthem.
Okay. I'm getting a lot of that, actually. I'm feeling very proud. Lots of patriotic Indians. Okay. The main ingredient for success?
Perseverance and excitement and courage to be able to make bold moves.
Awesome. If you were given $1 billion for Map My Genome, what would be those three things you would do?
I think one, definitely expand the team, expand both locally and geographically, and make sure that we can build the world's best store of information, that we can get anything out of it, any information from an overall machine learning and algorithm perspective.
Awesome. All right, Anu, an incredible pleasure speaking with you. As ever, I am still learning. I have a lot more to learn, but with every interaction, I get much richer. I think we've managed to understand a little bit more about the complex business and the effort that it takes in setting up an entire category and a business over it. I myself have seen the output of a report like this, and I know how beneficial it can be. And I do truly hope others, too, start venturing into this arena to try and understand what it takes. And ever since I met you, I think it was last year, possibly, I've been fascinated by that space. And I wish you and the team all the very best. Thanks so much for taking the time. And I look forward to jamming with you again soon. Awaaz.com